This is Harv Aronson of the Total Sports Recall Podcast, and I recently decided to give Sterling Soap Company's Ground Breakfast Blend coffee a try. While brewing, the aroma was inviting and the taste, lightly sweet and delicious, as the texture of this amazing coffee was sweet and smooth, as I experienced a coffee with a velvety texture, almost creamy. Sterling's breakfast blend is light but in no way weak, with a high quality taste and smell. My wife and I are now hooked on Sterling Soap coffee, and you should be too. Check out their coffees and other products at sterlingsoap.com. That's S-T-I-R-L-I-N-G soap.com.
Well, hello, everybody. This is Doug Levy bringing you episode number 5 of Under the Radar, Olympic Athletes You Gotta Meet, based in part on my book, Hero Redefined, Olympic Athletes Under the Radar. Give it a read if you get the chance. Today, I'm honored to host a 2-time Olympian in the sport of sprint kayaking, Mr. Cliff Meidel. I think you'll be as blown away as I was by Cliff's personal story and the severe challenges he faced and overcame in his Olympic journey. Cliff is also a native of Southern California, which is appropriate because we have Los Angeles on the cusp of hosting its 3rd Summer Games in just over 2 years, and ticket sales for that just got underway this week. So without further ado, let's bring Cliff into everybody's living rooms. Cliff, welcome to the show.
Hey, good morning, Doug. Thanks very much for having me on. Thank you.
Yeah, it's a pleasure to have you. I want to start, Cliff, by hearkening back to where you come from. I think if anybody has Southern California in their blood, it's you. You grew up and were raised in places like Manhattan and Redondo Beach. You graduated from Cal State Long Beach. You earned your MBA from USC. So you are the epitome of Southern California and Los Angeles. And I wonder if you could just share your perspective on what it's going to be like to have a world full of athletes descend on Los Angeles in 2028.
Yeah, this is extremely exciting. You can already feel the vibe in the air right now, especially going through LAX. You can see all the transformations that are going on. But, you know, this is an extremely pivotal moment for us in Los Angeles and obviously through the rest of the world, because, hosting an Olympics is a once in a lifetime, it seems like, opportunity to be able to have that experience, and especially for a lot of the youth here in Los Angeles and around the world. It provides them kind of like the real time feel on what it is. And, you know, you're taking something that could potentially be a dream that many of us have is competing on that stage into a total reality. And I think that is one of the big parts of having and hosting an Olympics here in Los Angeles. It's a great opportunity to be able to, you know, bring everybody together. We're a very diverse community here in Los Angeles, and it provides an enormous amount of opportunity. And hopefully there's going to be maybe those handful of kids, right, that see their Olympic idol that is out there competing and here live in Los Angeles. And then one of these days, they find themselves getting ready on that starting line as well. And so I think that's exciting. I remember looking back, when I was younger, I was only 17, 18 years of age. When we had Los Angeles in 1984, and it was insane. There were local people here that, I was following and were my heroes. And it was just such an exciting time to be a part of a process like that. And having Los Angeles now, its 3rd time hosting the Olympics, this is just going to be incredible. It's a great feeling.
That's great. And I love you hearkening back to what it must have been like for you as a kid, as a teenager, and thinking about other kids. I want to talk to you about some of the hurdles you've confronted in your life. But before we do that, can you maybe give us a little bit of a perspective about your upbringing as a kid and what sports you gravitated to, Cliff, and maybe where your initial Olympic dream started?
Yeah, so for me, I always like to paint myself in the picture as, where was I on the athletic spectrum? And I would think that, if that's fair to say, I was always like that mediocre athlete. I was Followed a lot in the footsteps of my father because he was a soccer player out of Germany. He immigrated to the United States. So did my mother as well too. I'm first generation German here, but
Okay.
so we kind of sometimes follow the path of what our parents do, and so we spent a lot of time as a family on the soccer field, and that was just a passion of the family, and also my parents were big into getting my brother and I outdoors, and that was something that was very
Love
common
it.
at that time. But I played I was introduced to a lot of different sports that I played, but I think I gravitated very heavily on the two primary sports. One of them was soccer, because of my father, and I went in through AYSO and then the Pacific Soccer League and did that. And then the other one was in martial arts. I was always very admired, if that's the right way to say that, of various different heroes, the Chuck Norrises, the Bruce Lees, and so my friends and I would start off by playing karate, and then ultimately that led into a disciplinary type of focus that I spent a lot of time doing as a young kid and things. And I think that really developed the groundwork. And I also dabbled a little bit in because I live near the beach here where I grew up in Manhattan Beach. And so we had a lot of exposure to water sport. And I remember testing out outrigger canoe paddling one time in Redondo Beach. And I did that for about a year. But I wasn't the number one pick. If you had a group of kids lining up, I was always in the middle of the road and all that. But I think that if I was to say where was my headspace at that time as a young kid, I was very competitive. I think that was a good thing about it. But my parents, they were very hard workers. My father worked for Delta Airlines for 38 years, and my mother was a grocer. She was a ran a grocery store in Manhattan Beach, and she was the manager there. And I think, we always hear the cliche, the apple doesn't fall far from the tree. And my parents were always very hard workers, and they instilled that in my brother and I. And I think that's where it translated. That intensity, it translated to being able to do the work that it took in order to be able to compete on a fair playing field.
Well, I'm going to ask you later on about role models. I think we just heard a possible clue there in the Meidel household, but I want to ask you too about something that happened in 1986, Cliff, when you were 20 years old. I'd say an understatement to say it had a profound impact on your life and an incident that jeopardized your life. And I know you've talked about this, but take us back to what happened when you were 20 years old and the accident that occurred and the tailspin it put you through and what you had to do to recover from all that.
Yeah, that's a great question, and I look back on that often, and I, kind of put myself into that moment, and then I kind of foreshadow a little bit, and see where I am here today, and there's a lot that goes into that hopper and into that basket, and so just to kind of give the audience an idea on what happened was is that I was 2 years out of high school. Where I went to high school at MiraCosta High School in Manhattan Beach, which was a phenomenal school. And we had an incredible amount of athletes, by the way. I like to put that plug in there. During the 96 Olympics and 2000 Olympics, I think we had close to eight athletes coming, competing in those two games. But anyway, very
Wow.
proud to be graduated from the school. But so, where was I at that time? Well, I was going to community college here, and I was also, very good with my hands. So I was in the trades, and I was about a year, 2 year plumber apprentice. And I remember that I got offered a job working on a construction site at the time, and I thought that balance would be perfect. If I could work, learn a trade, and go to college, one of these days I might be able to open up maybe a construction company or something of that nature. That was just kind of the wild thought, right? So I was a part of a great culture there at work, and I learned a lot, and I gravitated because that's kind of like the Cliff Meidel story. I gravitate a lot to role models, and that's a big part of my story is that you don't have to reinvent the wheel in life. You just have to be an intricate spoke in it, and just be the best that you can be. And I remember that one morning I was at working out on a job site, and life-changing experience. I ended up getting tangled up with these power lines and nearly lost my life. I had severe burns throughout my body. And one of the biggest parts of the burns that I had was the severe damage to both of my legs. I was burned over 15% of the body. But anyway, that kind of put me in a very tough spot. The first spot was fighting for my life at that time. I ended up having a cardiac arrest because of the severe amount of electricity that had gone through my body. But then, I find myself now in a hospital setting where I'm no longer in control. This is now in the control of my parents. And so I'm very thankful, that our family, didn't know much about medicine at the time. What they did know is how to persevere and push through. And I always like to state that my mother, she was one of those type of people that when you told her the word no, that meant on. It was like looking into the mirror. And so, every time there was an obstacle that I had, my mom overcame it. I remember she had told me a story that when she first came to the hospital, where I was in the trauma center, and they told her that she couldn't go and see me, so that no meant on. And she, went through the emergency room doors and thought to herself, well, if this is the last time I'm going to see my kid, I want to see him. And she was in a setting where you really have to believe in the human spirit, and you really have to believe in the higher above when you're going through a massive adversity. And my mom tells a story that she whispered into my ear, "Fight as hard as you possibly can fight to live." And then, sure enough, that the power of the human spirit, as I mentioned, obviously I'm here today because my mind and my body chose to live at the time. But it was very enduring for my family. There was a point in time where there was a massive change. I was at the most bottom that one can be in life, where I was going to have both of my legs amputated, and because of the severe burns to my knees. And so there was this word, this kind of circling around that there it might be a guy that might be able to take a look at my legs. And I remember my mother calling this doctor up at UCLA, and his name was Dr. Malcolm Lesovoy. And so one of the things was is that I was located in a private hospital, and he was located up at UCLA. And I remember my mom and even Dr. Lesovoy, who's an awesome friend of mine, even says, the story today, your mother called. And at first I had to say, listen, lady, there's nothing I really can do because I'm in a community hospital and Cliff is in a private setting. And and he ended up coming down to the hospital to take a look at my legs. And this was prior to an amputation. And I remember this guy walking into my room. And like I had mentioned before, I was at the bottom of the bottom. I was in dire straits. And it is absolutely amazing what you would grab onto, when you're in desperation like that. And I remember this man walking into my room. This was very late at night. Cowboy boots, jeans, a white t-shirt, and these massive biceps, So I was thinking to myself, who let the janitor in, because I was thinking anybody would think doctor, you coat and tie and all that. And so this man walks into my room and he kind of acknowledges the other doctors that were there and acknowledged my mother. But he walks straight up to my bed and he puts his hand on my shoulder and he says, "Hey, Cliff," with his very deep voice. And he says, "I'm Mal Lesovoy, not Dr. Lesovoy, but I'm Mal Lesovoy, and I'm here to take a look at your legs." And I remember that moment in time, and I still look back and get a little bit choked up about it, because at that point in time, I knew that I was probably going to lose the legs. And this guy walks into my life and puts his hand on my shoulder, and he lights this little flame of hope in my heart that just maybe this guy is going to be able to make a difference. And sure enough, Dr. Lesovoy was able to examine me. And a couple of days later, he came back to the family and presented what he was going to do. And he ended up saving both of my legs from amputation, where he took my calf muscles and grafted them up on top of my knees. But that kind of paved a long road, for me for recovery, because it wasn't something that was going to happen overnight at all. I was 3.5 months in the hospital, and then I had to, develop the courage at that point in time to learn how to walk again, which was one of the most difficult adversities I ever had to go through, was, being able to learn how to walk. And
Yeah, so it occurs to me that's 40 years ago, Cliff, and
no.
I can hear in your voice how fresh and raw those memories are. And so I think for people listening, can you help us transition? How does a 20-year-old who knows that he's lucky to be alive and lucky to have his two legs still, how does someone then transition into what you became, which was a 30-year-old first-time Olympian? I mean, that's a 10-year odyssey that would make for a great film in Hollywood, I would think, in your backyard, right? But can you take us through that?
Yeah, so a lot of times people hear the story, and it's not just snap, 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 things happened here. It's a long road.
Yeah.
I mean, I could tell you, Doug, if you were to walk up to me when I was in the hospital, and you were to say, "Hey, Cliff, one of these days you're going to be able to walk again." I was never able to run because of the damage to both my legs, and that's kind of how my story goes along, and where I wound up. And why I wound up on the water. But if you were to say that, "Hey, Cliff, one of these days you're gonna be able to walk," I would have said, I would have doubted you 100%. And then if you would have said, "Hey, Cliff, one of these days you're gonna compete in the Olympic Games," I would have told you, "You're talking to the wrong kid. You need to go down the hall or something," because that was one of the big things, is the belief process, and that community around me is what really, helped me. And I have to, I thank wholeheartedly. It wasn't, me that went through it. It was everybody around me. It was my parents, my brother, those people that were my role models at the time that were closest to me, that really provided a tangibility when it came to influencing and inspiring me. And then it was a team of a lot of people. A lot of times you hear the story about it takes a village, right?
Yeah.
And it does. And that's what going through adversity is, or through hardship, is that we learn from others, we're guided by others, and it was just a long road. And I remember Dr. Lesovoy telling me, "Hey, listen, I've done my 50%. You've got to come up with the rest of the equation." And I was never good at math, but what Dr. Lesovoy was talking about was is that I had to come up with that will, the
Yeah.
determination, and the fortitude to be able to get through this adversity. And then, I have to thank my brother, who is 4 years younger than I am. And
He gave you some tough love, right?
yeah, metaphorically, my brother basically said, "Look in the mirror and see what you have." And I was focusing so much on my lower leg limitations, on the negative, rather than focusing on what the positive is. But as you know, when you're going through hardship, it's hard to focus on positive. And so my brother basically said, "Look in the mirror." And the only thing I could see were the lower leg limitations. And he really tried to focus on, you've got the upper body, you got your brain, and you have your hands, and use the tools that God gave you, and don't worry about what you don't have. And
Yeah,
so
quickly give us your brother's name.
now his name's Norman. And,
Okay.
Norman, Cliff and Norm, like cheers. It's easy to remember.
Okay.
And so Norman was really, helpful to me, very much so, as a mentor and somebody that pushes, but also somebody that supports you through it. So he gets me involved in the canoe club down in Redondo Beach, which was tough love right out the gates, because you're showing up to a place where you've got these people that are great at what they do. It's a new culture and everything, and so I show up here. And I think that if I was to, take that 30,000-foot approach and kind of unpeel the onion and say, what did that provide for me, getting involved into canoe paddling as a sport? I think being able to travel around the world and all that, and paddle and be a part of a team, is a great thing. Some of my best friends from that I have today are still from the canoe sport, and all my sports that I had done as a kid, soccer and all of that, and my local, childhood friends. But I think that if I was to take that number one thing and pinpoint that, definitely I would have to say it's a place of belonging. And when you're put into a place of belonging, it allows opportunity for you to thrive. And I think
Yeah.
that's what it was. Is I remember a coach of mine, Bob Bice, down at Lanakila Canoe Club. Everybody was very inspirational to me, as I mentioned. But my coach told me that, he says, "Listen, I could teach anybody intensity, I mean, I could teach anybody, sorry about that, I'll back that up. I could teach anybody down here technique, but what I can't teach is the intensity. And I had that look in my eyes that I wanted to do it. And so I would grab and try to accomplish and so on and so forth. And that's the story.
But I think you're describing not only a physical metamorphosis, but a mental metamorphosis where psychologically you had to go from the bottom of the bottom you described to us a few minutes ago. So was it the canoe club and your coach who helped you mentally and psychologically to begin to re-believe in yourself? Do you remember sort of when that light bulb went on with canoeing?
I think that I think it was a process that happened along the way, because when you go through adversity, one of the or when you lean into things that are very tough in life, right? I mean, some people go through adversity and they are able to springboard and excel in life, and some people naturally will take on challenges, and that's how we find a lot of people that are very successful, is because they had to come through hardship. But I think what happened was is that it was learning how to walk again that developed a sense of accomplishment, being able to join a canoe club, and being able to get better at that sport developed a level of confidence. And we find that a lot of times, and a lot of things that I talk about as a motivational speaker, is the fact that it's all about repetition. If you repeat, 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 rinse and wash, and go through that whole process, it develops resilience. And then when you develop a resilience, it develops a level of confidence that allows you to springboard to other successes. We find that a lot of times, when we go through life, sometimes those foundational elements of hard work, determination, building resilience is applicable to so many different things and facets in life. You could take what you learn in the military, or take what you learn in overcoming adversity, or no matter what you do, and you can apply that to academics or anything like that. Once you learn how to work hard, it's instilled in you. And that's what one of the most important messages that I have. It's all about repetition and building resilience. And yes, to answer your question, Doug, I think that was a huge part of where that really actually married itself together when I was in the canoe club. And at that point in time, I was like a freight train. I just wanted to learn and thrive and learn and thrive, and we got better and better all the time as a group and also individually, and that ultimately got me to being able to be introduced to Olympic sprint kayaking through other mentors like Greg Barton and things like that. That was that is a famous kayaker in the United States. So it was just like a road of role models and inspiration.
That's great. Well, let's dig into sprint kayaking for a moment, because it's not exactly like track and field or basketball where everybody follows it all the time. It's one of these Olympic sports that we certainly latch on to when the Olympics come. But can you maybe just paint a picture for the listener of what sprint kayaking is like, and maybe tell us some of obviously, you went to the 1996 and 2000 games, but if you could, not only paint that picture, but give us a little preview of what we can expect in a couple of years. Maybe if there's some folks to watch on the United States team.
So we sprint kayaking, I always like to say that it's the same venue as rowing, except rowers go backwards, we go forward. So we're considered a high performance sport. So our event takes, first of all, being able to balance a sprint kayak or a high-kneel canoe is a very difficult process. It takes many years to be able to balance that, and then you got to combine that with strength and power, technique, and then obviously aerobic capacity. Our like you look at a sport like in the event that I was in Atlanta, in the four person 1,000 meter event, you're at the very end of the, you're getting fully lactate at the end of the race, and it's 3 minutes and 15, 20 seconds of going as hard as you possibly can imagine. So it is a sprint sport. We have races that are a little bit shorter than that. We do have 500s and 200s, but the thing is that it's a highly European dominated sport. I have friends of mine that are Olympic champions from other countries, like Hungary and areas like that. That it's a massive sport. You know, it is really big. And it's slowly coming now to the United States because we had this incredible opportunity a couple of Olympics ago where high kneel canoeing, which is one of the most difficult disciplines in the Olympic Games. It's a very tough sport. I don't want to say it's the most difficult, but it's a very
It's
difficult
up there.
discipline. And women were introduced, thankfully, to the sport, right? So we had an athlete. She was 17 years old. Her name was Nevin Harrison, or her name is Nevin Harrison, and she is just an incredible athlete. And
From my hometown of Seattle, I might add.
yeah, exactly. And so she brought a lot of light in the United States to the sport and around the world. She became Olympic champion, a world champion, Olympic champion, and then she also was a silver medalist recently in Paris. And so, you know, what does that do for a sport like us? It provides the awareness in the opening, and so now you've got friends of mine that are now that were my teammates, they're now coaching, and their daughters are at the cusp now of doing really well. And we've got other athletes here locally, Aaron Small and his partner, that are doing very well in the men's doubles event. And so over the last 20 years, they've been doing extremely well in all of that, and they're really up and coming. So we're hopeful that they're going to win an Olympic medal here in Los Angeles. But you know, highly European dominated sport, and I remember racing in the Olympics in Atlanta. That was my first go around, and first of all, I was just so proud to you know represent the United States, and I'm so proud to be an American. And I remember racing in the Olympics. It was just one of the most incredible moments at that time. You know, it just doesn't get any better than the announcer saying "Lane 5, USA," and you have to raise your hand and all of that. And so it was a great experience. And I remember at that time during the opening ceremony in '96, I was walking down the ramp going into the stadium there in Atlanta, Georgia. And you can imagine, you know, 100,000 screaming people, USA, as the team proceeded down into the field. And then all of a sudden, everything was like slow motion. It was really weird for me. It was like almost like my blood was oil. And I was thinking to myself, I've been here before. So what happened was, is when I was a young kid, 7th grade, 8th grade, I used to dream about competing in this large arena, but I really never knew what this large arena was, or better yet, Doug, did I even have the capability of competing at that level? Absolutely not, right? It was a dream of Cliff at that time. And I'd run down the ramp and dream about competing in this large arena. And it was, you know, this euphoric high as a young man and all of that. And then all of a sudden, at the 96 games, when I was walking down the ramp, that became a reality. So for me, it was one of those things where it was, you know, really that moment in time that was really special. And I realized that, you know what? Things change in our lives. Sometimes we accomplish things that we dream about, and many times that we don't. But I think the moral of the story is the important thing is never, ever, under any circumstance, let any dream, you know, you've got to believe in everything that you want to do 100% of the time, and never let anybody tell you that you can't do it, because you can. It's all from the neck up. You know, it's how bad you want it. And if you've got that taste in your mouth of accomplishment, you can go out there and do that. And then, as you can imagine, 4 years later, you know, there's a lot of times where, you know, you have these visions of making another Olympic team, and it doesn't happen, and it sometimes it does. And here we were in Sydney, Australia. I was in a doubles 1,000 meter event. Unfortunately, you know, for me, I wasn't an Olympic medalist, but I had one of the most incredible honors at that time, where I was able to carry the flag in the opening ceremonies of the Sydney Olympic Games, and that was just an incredible moment for me. So I remember at that
I think we're listening to someone. You've given us the snippet that motivational speaking has been part of your life. I think you're listening to someone who has the ability to motivate a lot of people. But I'm going to take my questions out of order for a second, Cliff, because I want you to reflect on that a little bit. You've just turned 60. You've had a successful career in a couple ways. I think you've been an asset management consultant. You've been a motivational speaker. So, and of course, you overcame physically, you overcame mentally. You showed that resilience you talked about. So, Maybe a two-part question if you're game for it. Share with us who your role models were and are, and then if you could give advice to those young kids maybe having the dream you talked about of envisioning a large arena and they're forming their Olympic dreams, what advice would you give to that 8, 9, 10-year-old kid down at the Canoe Club in Southern California?
Yeah. So I think that going to the role model, part one of the question is that, who are my role models? Who was Chris Bell's role models growing up? First of all, my parents were very inspirational for me. I've had some other role models growing up in whether it was martial arts or other things like that. But I think one of the most impactful role models for me, because, sometimes I'll define this and take a couple steps back. Sometimes role models can be intangible. Like I read a lot of stories of Muhammad Ali, Billie Jean King, and these people as I was a young kid in these Sports Illustrated books I would read, and I'd watch the wide world of sports. You remember that opening line, the thrill of victory and the agony of
Yeah,
defeat.
of course.
And then sometimes we can have tangible role models. And when I was a younger, I used to throw newspapers here in Manhattan Beach. And one of my on my newspaper route was a gentleman by the name of Tom Hintonhouse, who was a local role model for many people. And I remember he and I went to the same high school. Tom graduated from Aviation High School, and I was just a freshman down there. And I would try pole vaulting, which Tom was a two-time Olympian in pole vaulting, and an incredible role model at the time. And I remember how does this tangibility come into play? I remember knocking on Tom's door because everybody said, "Well, why don't we see if we could get Tom down here to the track and field venue, right, to teach us how to pole vault?" So I thought to myself, "Oh my God, I am scared out of my boots." I don't. And so I remember walking up to Tom, and I briefly talked to him and all of that, and I thought definitely, that it was going to be a slim chance. And he said, "Oh yeah, absolutely, I'd love to come down there." And so, unfortunately, I mean, fortunately, Tom came down, but the problem was it was a rainy day, and I was so bummed out because I thought it was this opportunity was all over with, but it wasn't, because Tom was has always been a very creative guy, and he says, "Here's what we do: grab your poles, and we're going to go into the gym." So we went into the gym and we had waxed the floors. I'm sure the basketball players weren't very happy about this. And I don't know if Tom's going to be listening to this. I remember that we were all wondering, what's going on here? Because we were all novice at that time. We're those straight pole guys that would, hit the pit and go straight over. And so he was really teaching us at that time, being able to bend the pole, get into our position with our legs, and then accelerate ourselves off the pole. And so that's where the waxing of the basketball court floor came, where we're able to bend it up against the gym wall and kind of catapult ourselves away from that. So, that was kind of like the first introduction to, and I knew Tom very well, and so did many people. He was a famous Calvin Klein underwear model and all of that, and in fact, he kind of broke the entire media and marketing throughout the United States with that ad campaign that he did. And so, I really looked up to him as my hero and everything. And then it became tangible because of the fact that it was that first introduction. And then Tom and I became friends. We saw each other in the gym and all of that, and I was on crutches, and he was always very inspiring to me, like, go get him, go for it, and all of that. And so that meant a world of a difference, because I was a canoe coach for a while down at the Canoe Club, and I remember telling all the athletes, always be humble, because of the fact you never know who's looking up to you. And that's the way role models work. You could be talking to a kid or talking to anybody about something, and you really don't know how impactful you are. And Tom was monumental for me. It was huge. He made a big difference in my ability to be able to go out there and try to accomplish the extraordinary just by watching what he did. He was a very disciplined person. We would watch him and see him running all the time through the neighborhood, and he was just so motivational for us because it was touchable, right? Where he was always would let you talk to him and everything like that. And then for me, going through my accident and everything, he was just so encouraging and all of that. And that for me lit that little flame of hope in my heart that I could maybe get through this adversity. And then when you add all these things together, at the end of the day, it's kind of like a mold that you put together. You have your role models like Tom coming in. You have your parents that are a part of the process. You have your brother, Dr. Lestivoy, Dr. Mandelbaum. I can, the list goes on and on, how that comes. But there are a few of them that make a big difference in your life. And I could tell you, Tom did at that time. It inspired me a lot, as an individual, and because of his incredible accomplishments, and I think more importantly, his incredible personality and his incredible friendship and all that. That's what really makes a big difference, when it comes to role models.
And a quick spoiler alert for listeners. I actually profiled Tom Hittenhouse in my book, and he wanted when I asked about his inner circle and friends, he wanted to make sure I talked to this guy, Cliff Meidle. So
Yeah,
that's how you and I first met, Cliff. But
and it's an, I just want to say, off the record, it's an honor, to be, to have Tom be able to, acknowledge that and everything like that. It means the world to me.
That's great. Well, you certainly gave us a litany of role models in your life. There are several, but as a really gifted motivational speaker, what's your 30-second elevator pitch for those kids down at the canoe club, or kids on the soccer field like you were, or kids just starting out forming their own dreams? What would be the best advice you could give those kids?
Well, the best advice is dream big, and go for the gold, right? If that, no pun intended for that. But I think one of the most important things is that, like I mentioned earlier, you don't have to reinvent the wheel. You just have to be a little bit of that spoke that's inside that wheel, be that intricate part of it, of the process. And if you have an opportunity to be able to have a role model that's tangible in your life, whether it's an Olympic athlete or anybody, your parents, that's huge. If you could really learn from them and create that tangibility and ask them those questions, what did you do during hard times? How did you overcome these difficulties? Because I can tell you that if you look at the story of a lot of Olympic athletes, it's a lot, there's a lot of hardship that goes into, and the dedication that it takes to be able to compete on that playing field, like all other sports too, like making it to the NBA or the NFL and all that. It takes a lot of work. And discipline and all of that. And if you're a young kid and you can develop that relationship with somebody that could kind of help you, guide you down the road, and if you can ask the right questions, and it'll make a huge difference in your life, I can tell you that. If you have the opportunity, go for it.
Well, obviously you have tremendous memories of the Olympic Games. As you said, you competed in two of them and you got the honor of a lifetime in carrying the US flag for those 2000 opening ceremonies. And I know you've collected several awards for courage over the years. So there's a lot to draw on here. So I'm going to ask you a tough question. Are there a couple of things or a couple of moments, Cliff, that you most remember or that you're most proud of, whether it's anything we talked about or just some other moment in time that you like to reflect back on and say, "Hey, that was pretty cool. I'm glad I went through that."
Yeah, I think that the I'll pick number one. This one's the it was one of my big highlights, was at the Olympic Games in Sydney, as you described. I was the flag bearer. I got selected for that. At first, I wondered how was I ever selected for something like that. But I was representing all of the delegation for USA, and I remember standing there. I was so nervous, Doug, you wouldn't even possibly imagine. And I walk like Bambi, right? I'm still missing a third of my knee compartments and all that. So I'm thinking to myself, Cliff, whatever you do, don't trip. And so I'm standing there, and the United States team is ready to have their procession into this opening ceremonies in Sydney, Australia. And I was about maybe 20 feet ahead of the team, standing next to this liaison person. I'm holding the American flag. It feels like it's rule heavy and all that, because I was just so nervous at the time. And the lady was like, "Okay, Cliff, get ready, Team USA, you're entering." And then all of a sudden, I took this deep breath, and I realized for a moment, you know, I am so proud to be an American, and I am so proud to be able to represent my country. And I'm so proud to be able to be in that place. It was almost like this was the payday for all of that work that I did all these years, you know, that I never thought I'd be able to accomplish. But
Yeah, you settled yourself.
I remember looking over my shoulder behind me, and the only thing I could see was for a quarter of a mile was a sea of red, white, and blue, and it was the entire United States delegation behind me coming into the opening ceremony. I remember walking out onto that field, you know, 2 billion viewers on TV, and I was carrying the American flag, and that was just such a proud moment for me. That kind of packages all this together. But I think that, you know, going on to your question again, you asked for a couple of them.
Yeah, what's number two? Numero uno, I think we got.
Numero uno was the base for all of this. I was so proud at that time being able to walk the 20 feet on the parallel bars. Now, there was a guy by the name of Jimmy, who was like an NFL linebacker, who was my PT guy, my physical therapist, and he was holding 95% of my body weight up with this belt that I had. But, you know, I remember looking, and Dr. Lesovoy says, "I'll give you 4 weeks. We've got to get from the bed into a wheelchair." And I thought,
Yeah.
right there, the music stopped. There is no way that I'm going to be able to get from the bed to the wheelchair. I had these jelly things on my legs, these muscle transplants, and I'm thinking to myself, absolutely not. But every day, it was all about just taking one micro steps, moving forward. It was just one small step at a time. Now, I had several days where I took steps backwards and things like that. I was having difficulties mentally and physically. But ultimately, that proud moment and that honorable moment came after a month of being able to learn how to walk again with Jimmy's help, on these parallel bars. I could not believe that I was able to walk that 20 feet. And so that set the foundation for me mentally, to be able to say that if I can accomplish that,
Yeah.
I can accomplish anything I put my mind to. And that's where that whole process of micro step, repetition, 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 repetition develops that muscle of resilience that develops the confidence and the
That
ability for us to
foundation
be
was
able to
laid.
springboard. That was that point in time where that was the realization. Now, did I ever think I was going to go to the Olympics at that time? Absolutely not. But it gave me the foundational tools to be able to apply that, whether it was going to college and finishing college and going into sports and having the confidence to do that. And so that's one of the big things for our listeners is that, you know, as we go through adversity or we go through hardships, and whether we want to lean into these things, it's all about developing that foundation, of resilience. I think that's the
Yeah.
most important part behind it. You know, we
Yeah.
all come from a different cloth, but I think the most important part is that we have a commonality of mindset when it comes to facing difficulties in life.
Yeah. Great lessons. Well, I'm going to transition into one final question for you. And it's about your beloved hometown. I think you gave us a preview at first. This is a little bit, I think, like asking Elton John if music is a good thing, but I'll go ahead anyway. You know, hosting Olympic Games is tough. Yeah, and there have been some great ones, and there have been some unfortunate tragedies. And so Los Angeles is gearing up for Act Three here. And you know, we have a lot of division in the world. We're going to bring all these athletes to Los Angeles in 2028. What's your preview? How do you think Los Angeles is going to do this third time down the aisle?
Well, in my opinion, and what I've learned, you know, from the past and all that, Los Angeles is unique to itself, and I think that we're one of the few cities in the world that can host an Olympics in 6 months. If you were to call LA and say in 6 months you got to have an Olympics, we can do it. We have all the venues and everything. We have the athletes' village very easily, and I think that we learned a big lesson. And I think the world, the IOC and everybody learned a big lesson in 1984 that an Olympic Games can be profitable. And that's what really developed like the LA84 Foundation, where we have the house on Adams Boulevard over there that has provided a lot for the youth community over all these years, and so on and so forth. So hopefully Los Angeles is going to be able to cookie cutter that effect and have the same results, where it can be a profitable Olympics. I'm not into the finance behind all of that stuff, so I don't know. But I think that on a world stage level with visibility and all that, LA's got it going on. We've got the traditional Coliseum, which is just incredible. It's the third time around that we're going to have people going in there during the opening ceremony. And then we have all these venues around LA that are going to be, it's going to be so much fun to be able to be in that environment and be a part of the entire Olympic movement. And we all could be a part of that process.
Well, for our listeners, if you don't if you didn't know Cliff Meidle was a motivational speaker, I think you're getting a few clues as to why he's pretty good at it now. And man, I hope we all get to have someone like Cliff Meidle in our lives. Cliff, it's been a joy to talk with you. This is going to be a wrap on episode number five. I want to invite everybody to join us next month for episode number six. We're going to bring in Canadian skiers Brian and Karen Stemmel to look back on the Winter Olympics that just was and some of the skiing events. So until then, we're signing off. Thanks again, Cliff, and thanks everybody for listening.
Yeah, thank you, Doug.
Hey there, sports history fan. This is Arnie Chapman, aka the Football History Dude, and I hope that you enjoyed this recent episode presented by the Sports History Network and were able to learn some good old-fashioned sports history knowledge nuggets. I started the Sports History Network back in 2020 with the mission to help podcasters find a community of like-minded sports history nerds, as well as helping aspiring podcasters to start their own shows. We have a little bit over 30 shows on the network right now covering all sorts of sports history, but as far as I'm concerned, we're just at the toothpick in the ocean moment, you know, that can't even figure it out because there's so much more coming. We wanted to create the ultimate headquarters for sports yesteryear, starting with Podcast Network and our website, but we're going to continue to move into other mediums as well. And here's the cool part, because we want you to be part of our team. So if you're interested in starting your own podcast, or maybe being a guest on one of our shows, or who knows, maybe even writing an article for us over on the website. Seriously, all you got to do is reach out to us on the contact page over at sportshistorynetwork.com. You can be as technologically savvy as a Neanderthal tapping on a stone trying to figure out this whole hieroglyphics thing back in the day. Again, it doesn't matter, because even if you don't understand the whole podcast space, we have a production team that can pretty much help you out with doing everything. All you got to do, head over to sportshistorynetwork.com, head to the contact page, fill it out. That message goes right to me, and I'll reach out to you as soon as I can. But for now, dude, I'm through if you're through.